Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The number of part-time jobs in the U.S. is growing. USA Today recently reported that part-time jobs made up 80% of the nearly 1 million jobs created this year as of September. That's great news if you're looking for a part-time job, but more people work part-time because they can't find a full-time job or because employers are cutting back worker hours. Joining us now to talk about some of the causes and potential effects of this trend is Heidi Shierholz of the nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank Economic Policy Institute. Welcome to the show, Heidi.
Thank you for having me.
So what are the root causes of this trend of increasing part-time jobs? Is it just a holdover from the recession or something more?
Yeah, that is the question. That is a key question. And what I see when I look at the data is that the evidence at this point is that it really is just about the weak labor market in the aftermath of the Great Recession. That we've seen this, as you've pointed out, huge increase in the number of workers who are working what I call involuntarily part-time. They're working part-time, but they want and are available for full-time work, but they've just had to settle for part-time schedules. That's largely due to the weak labor market overall.
Now, some people are looking for part-time jobs out there. You know, you see them in the Women's Day articles and that sort of thing. Women who don't want to work full-time while they have kids at home and that sort of thing. How do you sift out the people who want part-time from those that don't? How do you know how many are non-voluntary at this point?
This is one of those things where this big national surveys where they track the number of unemployed and number of employed and how long people are working, they actually ask people. If you're working part-time, they say, is this what you want? Would you rather have a full-time job? So we actually have really good information on what share of part-time workers want to be part-time workers and what share would rather have full-time work and are just having to settle for part-time work. And it's interesting when you look at the number of voluntary part-timers, people who are working part-time by their own preference, mm-hmm. that trend actually follows the trend that we've seen in full-time work. In other words, that trend, just like everything else, fell off a cliff in 2008 and 2009. We lost a ton of these voluntary part-time jobs. People wanted these jobs. They were, but just like full-time work, they lost them. Since then, we've sort of seen, like other things in the labor market, this very gradual healing. It's still below where it was before the recession hit, but gradually improving. The big increase that we've seen in part-time work since the recession hit, that's the involuntary part-timers. That's people who want full-time work.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about part-time work, part-time workers. My guest is Heidi Shierholz from the nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank Economic Policy Institute. Heidi, what about, we keep hearing about people who are working multiple part-time jobs. How many people like that are out there?
It's not very many, less than 5% of the labor force. So it's not many people would, if they could, cobble together a bunch of things. But at a time like this, job opportunities are just so scarce that people are, you know, they're feeling lucky if they can land one job. We're not seeing a big increase in the number of people who are working part-time who are working multiple jobs. And that's just a result of there's just not job opportunities out there.
And we often think of the typical part-timer as, you know, the high school kid working at the fast food restaurant. How do we describe a typical part-timer these days?
They are people whose families depend on those earnings to get by. They're, in many cases, the majority of them are grown-ups, people not teenagers, people age 20 and well over, who are contributing their earnings, contribute a big share of their household's total income. So these are workers who are not working for extra spending money. They're working because they need to provide for themselves and their family.
Do part-time wages tend to be lower as a rule than full-time wages, or I guess on an hourly basis, do they tend to be lower? There are part-time jobs out there that pay well, they're just not full-time.
Yes. Yeah, so there's a wide range. You can have people who are freelancers who would get a high hourly wage. But on average, if you look at, obviously part-time workers are going to have lower weekly wages than full-time workers because they're working fewer hours. So if you, just what you suggested, if you drill down and look at the hourly wage, they tend to have much lower hourly wages. But the other thing is their jobs tend to come with fewer fringe benefits. So if you're a part-time worker, you're much less likely to have a pension plan at your job or to have health care at your job. So not only are you getting lower hourly, tend to get lower hourly wages, if you look at the whole compensation package, these jobs tend to be much lower quality jobs.
Is this trend for the increase in part-time jobs, is this across the country? Are there any blips where there's an aberration, or is this pretty much across the country, everything from Atlanta to New York to L.A. to Columbus?
I think this is going on across the country, and here's why I think that's true. The big increase in the part-time that we've seen since 2007, that's due to the weak labor market. That's due to overall weakness. It's part and parcel of the same thing that is causing us to still have a very high unemployment rate. That weak labor market is across the board. There's no state that's been spared. There's no region that's been spared. So given that we're seeing this very broad weakness in the labor market, we're going to be seeing this big increase in people having to settle for part-time work because they can't find the full-time jobs they want across the board.
And just one more question. I want to bring in Amy Hanauer of Policy Matters Ohio to focus in a little bit on Ohio. But do part-time jobs, are they necessarily temp jobs all the time? Do we have any sense about how many part-time jobs are quote-unquote permanent part-time versus temp jobs?
Oh, that's a fine question. Maybe Amy will have some information. I have never seen that. I think there's definitely going to be a higher share of part-time work will be these temporary help jobs, because temporary help jobs are much more likely to be part-time. But you're also going to see a lot of part-time jobs that are, you know, you get hired on as a permanent part-time employee. So that's also happening a lot. And then the other thing that we see happening is you're a permanent employee and your hours got reduced. Your company just doesn't have enough demand for their goods and services. They don't need you for those hours that would put you, that would bump you up to full time. So you're a permanent employee and your company just won't give you the hours you need.
Amy Hanauer of Policy Matters Ohio, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
So are the causes at a micro level in Ohio the same as the rest of the country? It's that weak labor market overall?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are two things, and Heidi always has so much insight on all of these things, particularly on what's going on right now in the labor market. I think that I see two big things. I mean, one is we have a weak labor market because we had our economy almost go over a cliff and we had a terrible recession. And the other is a generation-long shift in the relationship between employers and workers, where we are seeing less of a commitment to workers and less of a commitment to a package of benefits, where employment used to be characterized by a full-time job with health insurance and retirement benefits and, you know, a package of things that came along with it and really a living wage that could support a family. That we've seen a trend away from that over the whole last generation, sort of through recoveries and recessions. And then the second thing going on is that we've just got such a weak economy.
We have an email from Matthew in Columbus. I want to read it and get your impressions of it. He writes, having balanced three jobs at once, I can tell you how physically and emotionally straining it is to only be able to find part-time work. Keeping employees at anywhere from 6 to 34 hours a week with no idea if, when, or how much they'll be working the next week is exploitative of the most vulnerable people in society. It allows employers to not only deny health and retirement benefits, but also any sense of job security. I work so hard to just barely survive from week to week. Most Americans have absolutely no idea or empathy for what it is like to be poor with no opportunity. I wanted to kind of break that down a little bit. Is this, Is it that simple, Heidi Shierholz, that employers are exploiting workers and they're doing it to relieve them of any sense of job security and get out of having to give them health and retirement benefits? Is someone out to get the worker here?
The employers might not think that, you know, feel like that's their end goal, but on the ground, that can end up being exactly what happened. So one of the things that this email, that was a really nice email, it laid out a lot of the issues that part-time workers are facing, is this totally erratic schedules that many of these workers face. Employers are moving towards, they want to be able to have workers on call, not pay them, but have them be on call. So if, you know, they're all of a sudden in a busy spurt, they can just call people and have them on the floor, but not have them if they're not in a busy spurt. So you can see why an employer would want to have that happen, and
sure,
you can also see why it absolutely adds chaos, instability, and insecurity to the lives of workers. And so that loops right back around to what Amy was saying, that this trend towards workers facing jobs that lead to more chaos, insecurity, and instability in their lives, sort of a generation-long trend towards that. This just-in-time kind of keeping workers on call just mm-hmm. when the employer needs them on the floor, it's pretty symbolic of that longer trend.
Heidi, how long do you expect this trend to last at this point? I know it's cyclical and historical. If you get it taken a historical look at it, it's happened before, but things are different this time.
Yeah, so this is where I'm both optimistic and pessimistic. So the pessimism is the longer run trend towards decreasing job quality that Amy underscored, that's not going to be solved by getting the labor market back to health. But a lot will be solved when we get into a really robust jobs recovery. So the big increase that we've seen in involuntary part-time work that was a result of the weak labor market in the aftermath of the Great Recession, when we do get a robust recovery, and I can't believe it's more than 4 years since the end of the official recession and we're still saying we haven't entered a robust jobs recovery, but we haven't. When we do get a robust jobs recovery, a lot of that problem will go away. Not entirely. We still have this negative trend towards decreasing job quality, but the big increase in people having to work part-time jobs when they want full-time jobs, a lot of that will go away when job opportunities are restored more broadly.
Well, Heidi Shierholz, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Heidi Shierholz, she is from the nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank, Economic Policy Institute. Amy Hanauer of Policy Matters Ohio will stay with us. And when we return, we will turn to the issue of the impact of Obamacare on the part-time labor market. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The number of part-time jobs in the U.S. is growing. USA Today recently reported that part-time jobs made up 80% of the nearly 1 million jobs created this year as of September. Some blame the increase on the Affordable Care Act. Obamacare does require most so-called large businesses, those with 50 or more full-time employees, to offer health insurance. Joining us now to talk about the potential impact of Obamacare on the employment picture is Tom Buckmueller. He's an economist at the University of Michigan. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And still with us, Amy Hanauer of Policy Matters Ohio. Tom, your research focuses on the economics of health insurance and related public policies. You studied the Hawaiian system. What did you learn from the Hawaiians?
Right. Well, the Hawaiian system has some similarities to the Affordable Care Act mandate and some differences. The Hawaii law, which was passed back in 1974, requires all employers to provide health insurance to workers who work more than 20 hours a week. So a little bit lower than the 30-hour week threshold of the Affordable Care Act. And again, unlike the Affordable Care Act, there was no exemption for small firms. So what we saw was, over a long period of time, over the 30 years or so since it went into effect, there was a slight movement towards low-hour work in Hawaii. So that the data seemed to suggest that some employers were shifting their workers to short shifts as a way to avoid paying the penalty or paying health insurance. But it was relatively small, and low-hour work is not real common.
And was it limited to any particular industries, businesses, fast food restaurants, that sort of thing, or versus?
Exactly, yeah. So it was, if you think about it, the mandate really bites for employers that have low-wage workers who they otherwise wouldn't offer health insurance to, people who are near the minimum wage. And, those labor markets are such that health insurance is not part of the standard benefit package. So it's not going to be binding for high-wage workers. Who are you going to offer health insurance to voluntarily? So we saw all of the impact was on lower-wage workers, and as you said, those are disproportionately in hospitality, retail, those kind of jobs.
So you said it was a slight movement toward lower, fewer hours. How do you extrapolate that to the national picture now, 40-odd years later?
It's hard to line it up exactly. As I mentioned, the Affordable Care Act threshold is a little bit higher at 30 hours. And so it's much more common for firms to provide health insurance to 30-hour-a-week workers anyway. And the 30-hour threshold, there aren't a lot of workers who are right at 30. You see quite a few, obviously, that are at 40 hours a week. Part-time jobs tend to be maybe 20, 25 hours a week. So the number of workers who are really sort of in the crosshairs of this policy in terms of, their employers have a tough choice of, do I offer benefits? Do I pay a penalty if they go to the exchange and get a tax credit? Do I shift their hours? It's relatively small, in percentage terms at least. Some of the estimates that I've seen are that it's about maybe 2% of the workforce are really going to be in that difficult situation.
If I can jump in here.
Sure, Amy Hanauer, yeah.
Yeah, this is really interesting, and it's great to hear this perspective from the case in Hawaii. I mean, there has actually been a little bit of research done on what's going on nationally. I was able to come up with two things. One from the Wall Street Journal, which found that there has been an increase in part-time employment during the recession, but that it was long before the health care law passed, and that actually during the past year, full-time employment has increased more than part-time employment has. So the Wall Street Journal found that actually that group working both full-time and working between 30 and 34 hours has increased over the past year. So it's an enormous problem when people can't get all of the hours that they want. But I think that some of the early evidence indicates that it's not going to be a huge factor. The sort of new health requirements don't seem to be materializing into a big factor. And I can talk a little bit more about another study if you're interested that I came across.
Well, tell us.
Yeah, so the Center on Economic Policy Research, Dean Baker, actually found that in the past couple of months, the percent of workers working more than 35 hours has actually risen slightly. And the percent working 31 to 34 hours has risen slightly. They also found that the percent working just below that has risen slightly. What CEPR found, the Center on Economic and Policy Research, is that what's really falling is the percent working very few hours, like 19 or below. So, this is really getting into the nitty-gritty. And I think as your other guest is pointing out, you're talking about a small percentage of the workforce because you've got employers who are trying to avoid health care no matter what.
Anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think what we have here is a situation where we're trying to say, number one, employment ought to come with health care coverage. And number two, you shouldn't even have to be working 40 hours a week to be able to be eligible for health care coverage. And number three, we're going to give you some more ways of getting access to health care. So one of the reasons that full-time jobs have been so important, as Heidi Shierholz said in the first 20 minutes, is that they do come with benefits, or they are more likely to have come with benefits in the past. That's what we want. I mean, what we want is workers to have the number of hours that they want, and we also want workers to get health insurance coverage, and frankly, we want them to get retirement coverage as well. That's what's been going away in America, and I think the health care law, you know, for the most part, is going to be a positive force in all of that, because it's going to be saying, here are some other ways to get health coverage if your employer hasn't offered it to you. And in fact, we're going to make sure that more of your employers do offer it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Yeah, Tom Buckmuller?
Sure, yeah, if I can add to that. Some shift to part-time work after 2014 when the new coverage options are available is going to be a very good thing, because it's going to be coming from worker choices. As Amy said, a lot of workers now, the only way to get health insurance is to work full-time. So if you're a parent with young children and you'd like to work part-time, a lot of times you're forced into this either-or situation where either you get benefits or you work the shorter hours that you want. Having these other coverage options through the exchange, through Medicaid, is going to allow people to work the hours they want. Think about workers sort of at the end of their careers. They might want to wind down, you know, work part-time as they move towards retirement. That hasn't been possible in a world where you have to work full-time to get benefits. So a lot of these shifts, and it's, you know, there are other forms of job lock. We know that some people want to start companies, and they're afraid to do it because they don't want to give up their benefits. They want to retire early. And the same thing, they feel locked into their jobs. So a lot of these labor market changes are actually good things.
Tom Buckmuller, to what extent does the idea of perks and the fringe benefits of a job matter anymore, or will matter going into the future, when it comes to attracting that high quality labor, that high quality workforce, highly educated? You know, is it going to matter anymore after healthcare benefits are available?
I think it will.
Okay,
I think it will. I mean, for some small firms, they may decide that they, you know, this is the time to stop offering benefits, that their employees are better off in the exchange. But for large firms, the business case is still going to be strong. You know, a big reason why employers offer health benefits is that it's excluded from taxation. There's a big subsidy that's coming from the tax code. That's not going to change. So as long as workers can buy benefits, essentially, with pre-tax dollars, they're better off getting them through their employer than going out and purchasing them individually. Large firms have a lot of advantages in providing benefits. There are really huge economies of scale. It's just lower cost in terms of administration. Large firms can do really innovative things in terms of benefits and negotiating with health insurance plans. So that value is going to still be there. So I don't see large employers getting out of the business or their employees wanting them to.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Walter now. If folks out there want to join the conversation, have a question, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Walter, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Now, yeah, you're a small business owner, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I've kind of always been in business, both in Sweden and in here. And the thing that just, I sometimes find this whole conversation kind of funny, because as individuals, as a good example, when gas prices go up dramatically, people start thinking about buying a smaller car, and hybrid or something like that. As a business owner, being small or large, you don't have a choice. You always have to think every moment about how to become more competitive. So, for instance, if you're able to provide the service that you want to provide to your customer at the right quality, and if you can do that with an employee and not having the extra cost of health care, you will do that. And if you don't do it, you will be out of business. And that's like, it's not like the business are being greedy. It's just we're all competing with each other. And if we don't do the smartest possible, and I would say for many things, it's not possible to do it with part-time.
Well,
but if it's doable, you have to.
Walter, let me ask you this. In your business, are you also competing for the highly educated employees out there, the ones that are desirable and are doing the jobs that require a lot of education and a lot of compensation?
Actually, the crazy thing right now, we just filled a team in a company. We just filled a part-time position, and the number of people with college degrees, master's degrees, applying for part-time was scary. I was very, very saddened to see how desperate people are out there. It just touched my heart. So I think it's so sad to have whatever 80% of all new jobs coming part-time, and I believe if you go back so many years, the situation was nearly totally reversed.
Okay, Walter, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, bye. Amy?
Yeah, and that's a great call that Walter made, and I think that he's exactly right in a bunch of ways. What we want to do is to really set a playing field where it is advantageous to offer your employees good wages and decent benefits. And if we don't have any standards, then you sort of have this race to the bottom, as Walter was describing. But if you say, you know, every employer has to offer health insurance or every employer has to offer a certain wage, then what you have is you can't race to the bottom below that person and still be complying with the law. So I really think that Walter's making a great case for having decent standards, and then everybody's competing on a level playing field. The just little point I want to make is that if he's a teeny little business, he shouldn't be subject to the requirements of the Health Insurance Act anyway, because it doesn't apply to very small firms. But that's sort of an aside. I think the larger point is we actually want standards so that employers have an incentive to offer good jobs.
Tom Buckmueller, how could something like the Affordable Health Care Act play out over time in terms of how it changes our work culture? Do you think it's going to have a big impact, or do you think it will be a short-term blip and things will go back to whatever the new normal is and it won't really matter?
Well, you know, I think the biggest change in terms of the labor market, and Amy mentioned this, it's going to give people other options besides employer-sponsored insurance, and that's going to give them more flexibility to choose what they want to do. 90% of firms that are 50 employees and above, which are the firms that are going to be subject to the employer responsibility requirement, already offer health insurance. If you get up to 100 employees and above, it's 100%. And as I said, I don't think that's going to change. So employers are still going to want to offer good benefits to compete in the labor market. But, you know, the model doesn't fit for everybody. It doesn't necessarily fit for the small business person. It doesn't fit for somebody who's self-employed or an independent contractor. Mm-hmm. And so this gives them a source of insurance outside of a large firm and gives them more freedom.
You know, I was reading in preparing for this show that the generation coming up now, the millennials, I guess, they're more entrepreneurial in general. They're looking at the future as something they're going to have to create from scratch. They're not going to be able to go into a big company and get a job and get all the perks and so forth, and that they'll be able to adapt better because of Obamacare.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's a movement towards a more flexible labor market with, you know, as Amy said, a safety net there. And you need that. If there's a safety net, then people are going to be more likely to take chances, take risks, do things that are entrepreneurial.
Amy, did you have...
Yeah, I think that Tom's exactly right that you, I know that when I started Policy Matters Ohio, the organization that I work for, and part of the reason that I felt able to do that was that my husband is a professor and had health care benefits for the entire family, and so I was able to be on his health insurance, which kind of gave me the freedom. That freedom is going to be more widely available through the exchanges now so that people feel that they can maybe take some risks. But the one thing I do want to just counter is there's a great piece in last month's American Prospect that I definitely recommend to all your readers called The Task Rabbit Economy, where Bob Kuttner writes about this idea that everybody has to sort of constantly be so entrepreneurial, and that that's always a positive. I think it is a positive when people can be entrepreneurial. But I think, as your first email that you read at the beginning of the show, Anne, pointed out, you know, there's also a lot of anxiety inherent in the idea that everybody has to be hustling all of the time. And I think that there's a real virtue to saying, you know what, show up and do your job and do it well, and you're going to be employed. And I really would like to see us as a society, you know, taking care of some of the basics for people, making it possible for people to work hard and, of course, to be flexible and change, but also, you know, not necessarily buying into the idea that getting rid of all of the security that came with our post-war economy that was so much of the 20th century, you know, that was how we built the middle class. And the fact is that, and I know Tom, with the research that he's done, I'm sure agrees, like our lives, we go through changes. There are going to be years when you're having a baby or raising an infant or where your elderly parent is ill, when you're going to want to be able to just kind of come in and do your job and also live your life. And then there are going to be other years, you know, your kids have just gone off to college, or you haven't had children yet, or you don't have children, where you really want to hustle and get ahead and learn more and push yourself. Mm-hmm. And I would like to think that the most productive economy in the world can offer opportunities to both of those kinds of workers.
We have an email from Matthew. He asks, could your guest touch on the expanding role of internships and how companies are using them to replace full-time jobs with perpetual unpaid labor? Tom Buckmuller, any sense about that?
I guess I don't have much sense beyond the anecdotes that you hear. And it does sort of create this unfair competition. If you're thinking about it, you know, these millennials are coming out of college. The ones whose parents can support them are going to be, you know, able to do those jobs. And so I think it is sort of a troubling trend, to the extent that it is a trend. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of data that quantifies how big a deal this is.
Agreed. Neither have I, but a lot of anecdotal evidence. But anyways, Tom Buckmuller, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Tom Buckmuller, he's an economist at the University of Michigan. Coming up, we're going to talk about the part-time worker as college professor, the adjunct faculty you hear about. A lot of it, Ohio State, all over the place. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Maybe you picture only a teenager when you think of the typical part-time worker. But according to a report from the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, you would be off by 10 to 20 years. And increasingly, a part-time worker could be someone as well-educated as a college professor. Joining us now to talk about this and its impact on education is Matt Williams of the New Faculty Majority, an organization for adjunct faculty members. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Ann.
How has the number of adjunct or part-time professors in the U.S. system of higher education changed over time?
You know, it's been quite remarkable, actually. About 30 years ago, it was typical to have somewhere between 15 and 25% of all professors on a college campus teaching on a part-time or contingent basis, meaning that their employment is contingent upon any number of different factors, including enrollment levels and such. In the last 25 to 30 years, that number has basically inverted, so that now in the United States nationwide, approximately 75% of all faculty are contingent, and that includes part-time faculty as well as non-tenure track faculty and graduate students who are teaching courses.
Now, I know 30-odd years ago, it wasn't necessarily about saving money. Some of my adjunct professors worked other jobs and were hired to teach because they were working professionals in the journalism field. That was a value that they were adjunct.
Sure. And this is a, you know, and it's perhaps that's where things started with adjunct faculty. But the reality is that adjunct faculty have been more commonly used over the last 25 to 30 years as a way for higher education to basically shift costs, and to reallocate their budgets toward things that are not going on in the classroom. We see higher education administration costs exploding. We see, obviously, lots of construction on college campuses. And so today, it's really a myth that the adjunct faculty member is a professional. And I'm not saying that there are not obviously professionals who are teaching as adjunct faculty members, but the reality is that most adjunct faculty members rely upon their teaching as their primary source of income. Although it seems like higher education administrators continue to invoke that that sort of analogy to try to prove or justify that, you know, that the use of adjunct faculty is actually beneficial to students.
Is there any evidence that this is more prevalent, say, in the private, independent higher ed industry versus the public education system, the Big Ten versus, the Ivy League?
No, what I would say is that it's more prevalent at the community college level than anywhere else, where as many as, say, 90% of all faculty are contingent. It's very common in for-profit institutions, but unfortunately, it's also common at state universities such as my alma mater and my former employer, the University of Akron, which employs roughly two-thirds of its entire teaching faculty are part-time faculty.
So how does an adjunct faculty position compare to a tenured faculty position in terms of hours worked, money made? What's the ultimate difference financially?
Sure. Financially, it's just an absolute train wreck. Nationwide, an adjunct faculty member can expect to earn about $2,700 per course. On an annualized basis, that results in an income of right around $25,000. You also need to keep in mind, though, that that most of these faculty do not receive any sort of benefits from their institution. They don't have access to health care. They don't have access to paid sick time and paid time off. And in many cases, don't even have access to any sort of retirement benefits.
Is there any evidence that there's a difference in the quality of the education a student's receiving from an adjunct faculty member as opposed to a full-time faculty member?
You know, the quality of the education, and this is a very important issue to new faculty majority, to the organization that I serve on the board of and serve as vice president of, it's a very important issue for us. Yes, there are qualitative issues, but those qualitative issues derive from the conditions under which these faculty work. And you know, we commonly say that a teacher's working conditions are a student's learning conditions. When you have a teacher who is teaching at 2, 3, 4, in some cases even 5 different institutions, trying to cobble together some semblance of a living wage, then it really does create those sorts of issues and problems.
My guest is Matt Williams from the New Faculty Majority. It's an organization created to support adjunct faculty members in higher education. If you have a question or comment for Matt, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Matt, there have been efforts to organize adjunct faculty. How is that going? How is it working? And how is it compared to how the tenured track type people are organized?
Sure. First of all, there are some structural barriers in some states, and Ohio is one of those states. Here in Ohio, part-time faculty at public institutions are specifically excluded from the definition of state employees for collective bargaining purposes, meaning that firemen can unionize, public firemen, policemen can unionize, public university tenure track full-time professors can unionize, but part-time faculty cannot, for all intents and purposes, cannot unionize. Now, that being said, we have seen a market uptick over the course of the last year, year and a half, in interest among contingent faculty or part-time faculty in unionizing. First of all, let me also state that New Faculty Majority is not a union. However, we certainly see the value in unionizations. Unionization, we think that that's something that's best decided at the local level. And we've seen a real uptick here. We've seen the SEIU get really involved in organizing adjuncts in a number of places, including Boston, Seattle, and Los Angeles. There's been a unionization effort at Georgetown, at Tufts University, Duquesne, Pacific Union over in Seattle. So there's been quite a lot of activity here over the course of the last year and a half or so, and we think that that's encouraging. Unfortunately, when you see the sorts of structural barriers such as exist here in Ohio, we think that that's most unfortunate, and quite frankly, has driven the shift in the use of contingent faculty member over the last 25 years.
Now, let me make sure I understand. They can't organize even separately from the public employee or the Ohio, the organization that represents public employees?
Sure. So there's technically there's nothing that would keep them from organizing. The problem is that their public university employers are not compelled by law to recognize them and to bargain with them. So there was a unionization drive at the University of Cincinnati some years ago, in which the part timers managed to form an organization, but ultimately the institution refused to recognize them. So you know, without compulsory recognition, it's very difficult to really achieve a whole lot. Not saying that it's not worth organizing and unionizing, but if you can't compel your employer to bargain with you, then what's the point?
What is the stake that the tenured track folks have in all of this? Because, as you said, most positions on college campuses, 75% or more are with adjunct faculty. That means that the tenure track is shrinking.
That's correct. And this has really been quite unfortunate, because what we're seeing is a reduction in the number of tenure track lines at our universities and colleges. And that means reduced opportunity. It means that the tenure track faculty are taking on more of a burden. And it means that the profession overall is being deprofessionalized, and that's bad for the profession, and it's bad for students.
Daniel in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Howdy. Yes, I'm interested in finding out the dichotomy that's going on with adjunct professors, and basically the universities are paying less.
Mm-hmm.
And tuition prices are skyrocketing, and where he sees that money is going, and also what is the fact that these adjuncts aren't required to do any research and possibly do more teaching, what is that in terms of doing to the bottom line of the universities as well?
Matt Williams.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are some excellent questions, Daniel. Let me deal with the first question first, and I'll give you an example from the University of Akron, which is a publicly supported university here in Ohio. The University of Akron's budget is approximately $400 million per year. Only about 2.5% of that $400 million annual budget is spent compensating the more than 1,000 part-time faculty who teach over half of all undergraduate course sections at the university. At the same time, the university's president and 35 or so vice presidents earn over half in cash compensation alone of what those more than 1,000 part-time faculty earn as a group. So I think that helps put in context just how few resources are actually being expended on direct instruction in the classroom. And we're really starting to experience a fair amount of solidarity with students who are outraged at the fact that their tuition continues to climb and climb and climb. And at the end of the day, they're more likely to encounter a professor in the classroom who is earning a poverty wage and does not have health insurance than they are to interact with a tenure track faculty member. So it really is a bit of a conundrum, and the reality is that the resources are being shifted to other things, palatial student centers and buildings and athletic programs and higher education administrative salaries, and away from resources in the classroom. to...
Amy Hanauer?
If I can jump in, I mean, I haven't wanted to because it's just so interesting to listen to Matt, and he is clearly just so well informed about this issue, and also it's just so impressive to me that he is doing this advocacy, because really I think he's saving higher education for my kids, who I hope will attend higher education in the next couple of years. You know, it's really just outrageous. I mean, here we have a profession that never was an incredibly high-earning profession, but where people who were sort of devoted to learning and to scholarship could find a home in our economy and could pass on that knowledge to the next generation. And we're impoverishing the people who want to deliver that kind of value to our kids, and it's just crazy.
Well, Matt Williams, I mean, I always had the impression, and it's just an impression, that you know, tenure track professors, people who get tenure, they make a very good living. They're pretty well off, and they get breaks, and they get, you know, I mean, there's a lot of perks that go along with that.
Sure, and I guess that to some extent, and I've written on this in the past, but, you know, faculty writ large have a branding problem, because that is the common perception, I think, in the mind of the public, is that tenured track faculty sit around in smoking jackets, drinking Chianti and smoking cigars and taking long sabbaticals. And the reality is that faculty work very, very hard, and it's very difficult, especially in the current competitive environment. It's very difficult to secure a tenure track position, mm-hmm. and so they deserve to be rewarded. Now, I'm not saying that they're being rewarded even on par with other folks that have comparable levels of education, and you know, and are able to achieve similar levels of success in their professions. We don't hear about doctors and lawyers and economists and, you know, and biomedical engineers. You know, we don't hear about their compensation levels the same way that we hear about the compensation levels of teachers. Yeah. So I would say, first of all, that they're not overcompensated for sure. And secondly, that if you look at the overall compensation in higher education faculty, it really is abysmal.
We have an email from Sarah I wanted to shoot at you, Matt Williams. She writes, adjunct faculty also get hit by enrollment numbers. My husband teaches at a small liberal arts college, and they have the same enrollment minimum as Ohio State, a minimum of 7 students. OSU can much more easily get 7 students into a class because they have a larger pool to pull from. My husband is teaching a class with 4 students because it is a required course for graduation and could not be canceled, but he gets paid less because there are not 7 students in the class. Teaching 4 students versus 7 students is the same amount of time and effort, more effort to keep fewer students engaged, but he doesn't get paid for it.
That's unfortunate, and that really is an abusive employment practice to pay somebody differently because the institution, you know, derives a different, you know, amount of value or benefit from the same amount of input. It just, to me, that's outrageous.
I'm going to try to get a real quick call. Rob, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in. Welcome to the show. You are an adjunct professor?
I am. I'm currently driving between Columbus and Newark, Ohio. I teach at 3 different colleges right now.
Okay, be careful driving, but in like 30 seconds, can you tell us what you want to say?
I just want your guest to speak to the waiver that most adjunct faculty have to sign, saying that they will not be eligible for Social Security benefits at the end of their lifetime or if they get injured.
Hmm. Oh, even though you're not getting the benefits. Interesting, Rob. Now get back to driving. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
So even if you're not able to get all the benefits, but you're also not able to even get Social Security benefits.
Yeah, this is something that's really a concern for us here with the Ohio Part-Time Faculty Association, as well as New Faculty Majority. Public university faculty in Ohio are exempted from contributing to Social Security and therefore will not receive the benefit of their time teaching at their institutions. Instead, they're placed into the state teacher's retirement system. The problem is that most folks attrite from the system because it's not a sustainable profession. Right. They attrite from the system, end up withdrawing their funds out of necessity, pay outrageous penalties and taxes, and don't have the benefit of the Social Security at the end of the day. So it's very scary.
Matt Williams from the New Faculty Majority, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jan.
And Amy Hanauer of Policy Matters Ohio. Amy, thanks for staying with us today. We appreciate it.
It's been delightful.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.